Just like I told you, the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'll tell you again, on the Danforth on Saturday at on December 6th, from 11 to 5, there is a Friends of Cuban 5 have Cuban books and DVDs and CDs. And by the way, and I'll thank Phil Connor very much for this, the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War .ca has the statement written by David Jacobs. He was invited to write a legal brief on the issue of Canada's possible involvement in an attack on the sovereign state of Syria. And you can read it there. My guess, this is now the internet age, you just put David Jacobs and you'll not only get his piece, but you'll get a contrary piece and a bunch of comments. At the end of the day, you'll be a lot brighter than you were. At any rate...
Sorry, Phil, the address on Danforth.
260, isn't it? 290.
Okay, that's what I'm asking.
290 Danforth.
290 Danforth.
290 Danforth.
Saturday at 11 o'clock.
Yeah. 11 to 6. Yeah. 11 to 5. Okay. Oh, they might stay open another hour if a bunch of you show up. And now we're welcoming Larry Krotz. How you doing, Larry?
Nice to be here, Phil.
Good to see you. You're the author of many, many books. You used to write for the Globe and Mail, and you're a feature writer. But this is a special book. It's your memory of being a kid at Christmas time. It's called A Child's Country Christmas, and we want you to read a chapter from that, and then we want to talk to you about Ontario farmers.
All right.
Okay.
All right. I will. I guess the Grey Cup game has been played. Advent arrived yesterday, so it's safe to talk about Christmas now.
Yes. Grey
Cup. Okay. The book is A Child's Country Christmas, and let me talk for a minute about sort of the background of writing the book in the first place. I grew up on a farm in southwestern Ontario. My parents had a farm north of Stratford in Perth County. We had cows and pigs and chickens and horses and so on, and that's where I grew up in the 1950s. And I've spent much of my life since then trying to figure out how to write about that world, because, as you said, I'm a writer and a journalist. I struggled with it because it's a world that has changed quite dramatically in the decades since it was my world. In many ways, it's been under assault. The economy, the communities, the culture have all been dramatically pressured. And we can talk about that if we've got some time at the end of the show. And so I thought, well, you know, do I roll up my sleeves and go, do an investigative, serious tome on rural Ontario, and if so, where would I start? I pushed this way and that, and finally decided, no, maybe the best way to approach this would be to start by just writing simply about the world as I saw it when I was growing up, and it was a special world then. Mm. So Child's Country Christmas is rural Ontario seen through my 9-year-old eyes.
When you were a 9-year-old reporter.
When I was a 9-year-old reporter. At that time, it was when you're 9 years old, everything's a fully packaged culture for you. But I think beyond the 9-year-olds, it was a fully packaged culture in ways that it isn't now. I wanted to look at the schools and the churches and the family structures and the shopping in the local towns and all of those things. The piece I'm going to read is about the Christmas concert that was held at the school I attended. We make a big deal about community schools and local schools. Well, in those days, they really were local schools and community schools. I went to what was commonly known as a one-room country school, which was grade 1 to grade 8, all in one building. If you drive through rural Ontario now, you'll see these buildings. They're occupied by weekenders from Toronto for the most part. But the buildings are still there. They've been converted, many of them, into weekend or holiday homes. When we were kids, they were our schools. And when you got close to Christmas, you had a concert.
Uh-huh.
So, with your permission, here
Please
we
do.
Go. School was the nexus of a war zone. With the arrival of the first good snow, that is to say, snow we believed would last, the scrubby corners that had served as a baseball field all summer became Monte Cassino, Flanders, the Alamo, Queenston Heights. The kids who lived east along the concession road constructed their fort, while those of us who lived west scrambled to put up ours with blocks we turned to ice by splashing them with freezing water. We then took up positions and belted one another with the hand grenades of snowballs. The battles went on ceaselessly, before the morning bell and through every recess, with a parting barrage at the end of the day. There was a geopolitical history to our rivalry, about which, in the obliviousness of childhood, we were only vaguely alert. Those from the east were Irish, or Brits, Presbyterians, originally from Ulster. We, from the west, were Germans. Krauts, my name, right? It was the World War all over again. Somewhere, tribal memories remained alive in the ice-packed snowballs that could make you cry when they struck you on the side of the skull and cause you to hold a bitterness toward the thrower that might last into the next day or the next decade. I ducked as a missile whistled past and then, hearing the splat of a direct hit, turned to find Fatty Detweiler writhing on the frozen ground holding his head. My cousin, whose nickname, an acknowledgement of his father's enterprise and the chores he had to do at home, was Pigstarter, peered over the battlement. Nicknames, by the way, were a point of honor. Like aristocratic titles, if you didn't have one, you were nobody. They were always appropriate and sometimes cruel. Pigstarter's older brother, because of the high pitch of his laugh, had been known as Hen. Another fellow was Horseface, and a third was called simply Silly, which alliterated to his surname. My friend Georgie was Pud, derived from Georgie Porgy Pudding and Pie kissed the girls and made them cry. I got off easy with a diminutive Krotzy. Across the icy waste of the 10-foot-wide no-man's land that separated our forts, Soup Campbell stood atop his side's slippery wall and emitted an ancient battle cry. "You hit Fatty with a frozen one," we yelled, and our side rose as one with a stormy barrage that knocked him from his perch. Only at that point could we stop to see if Fatty was all right. He was breathing. His face had turned purple, but he would not be out of it for long. The iced snowball was contrary to the Geneva Convention. Should there be a rock hidden inside, it constituted a war crime. Yet, our arsenals equally contained both sorts of ammunition, just in case. At which point, the bell rang, and we all had to go in for arithmetic. The school, a box-like building of red brick consisting predominantly of a single high-ceilinged echoing room chilly in winter, was situated a kilometer and a half from our farm gate. In spring and fall, my brother and I rode our bicycles. In winter, we were forced to walk, hoping against hope for mercy, in that should the mercury drop below a certain point, we would at last be driven by Mr. Noble or someone else from the parental carpool organized at our end of the line. Or possibly, in a swoop of delirious surprise, one of the men who owned a team, even my own dad with his two frisky Belgians, would hitch to a flatbed sleigh and turn the conveyance normally used to haul milk cans into a short-term school bus. Every kid along the road scrambled to hop aboard, and for extra measure a toboggan, or sometimes two, got roped on behind. To arrive at the schoolhouse just before the 9 o'clock bell in such rollicking style carried a double benefit. We had the joy of the ride, and at the same time could watch the envy spread across the faces of those from the east, waiting already with their icy grenades in hand. All of a sudden, however, as if a magical truce had been signed, the battles that had been going on every recess for weeks ended. We put down our snowballs, stopped being warriors, and all became thespians. It was Christmas. With roots that lay in some ancient solstice ritual, the season around Christmas became synonymous with dramatic spectacle. Abruptly, in every schoolhouse, church, and community hall, local theater reared its expectant head. The desire to entertain our friends and neighbors, kept in check by an endemic modesty the rest of the year, could be contained no longer. Every child suddenly had the ability to be an actor. Every adult became a director. Atop the desk of Mrs. Carter, our teacher, materialized a stack of books with plays and playlets made available from big city publishers to hinterland nooks and crannies like ours. They were, for the most part, morality plays of the sort that left the audience believing that no matter what catastrophe might befall the characters, it could be a fine Christmas after all. Songs and skits would fill out the show. Mr. Gottfried, whose son Wiener was in my class, arrived in his truck with hammer and saws, sawhorses and lumber. Teacher ordered the older boys to carry the desks to the basement and stick them beside the furnace. Then help Mr. Gottfried lug the sawhorses and planks through the too narrow doorway. Huffing and puffing, the older boys set the sawhorses down as trestles. Mr. G then showed them how to position the planks. We had a stage. Horseface climbed a ladder to stretch wire from one end of the room to the other, and the bed sheets we'd all brought from home got strung onto this wire attached with safety pins. The stage was curtained. We looked about. Our schoolroom had become a hall, and in it, on some not distant dark night, to all the parents and small not yet in school brothers and sisters, and maybe the older, already out of school young people steaming in their bulky coats and winter galoshes, we would present our concert. Those were the days when schools were truly local and of the community. There was one like ours on every road. The teacher was at the mercy of the community. There was no union for her. Mrs. Carter managed 40 of us spread out across every grade from kindergarten to grade 8, an answer to a school board made up of our fathers. The system was not so much democracy as local government at its height. My father was one of three trustees. My uncle Alex was secretary of the board. My aunt Pearl, who lived on a farm just behind the school and whose dog, Lucky, hung around enough to get adopted as our official mascot, was the caretaker, as well as on and off and on providing lodging for young teachers. Mrs. Carter did not need lodging. She and her husband had their own farm just up the road. In the booklets Mrs. Carter ordered from Toronto and Chicago were enough plays, skits, recitations, and poems to build our entertainment. For months, we'd been learning Christmas songs from the itinerant music teacher who appeared one morning a week. Now that the presentation was actually upon us, his job got taken over by a local person, sometimes my mum, who served as accompanying pianist. We had a fairly good choir. Soup Campbell could sing like a lark. There was additional musical talent as well. Silly had a violin. My cousin Pigstarter could play the ukulele. As the day approached, everything about the impending performance began to fall into place. On the stage, Fatty Detweiler turned into an accomplished, if a bit overzealous, actor. The little kids were given recitations of no more than 3 or 4 lines and were expected to get by on their cuteness. My group, at age 9, quite in the middle, were entrusted with drills and skits and duets, a kind of no man's land of mediocre roles with the promise only that they were getting us ready for greater things in the future. At the pinnacle, though, was one performance above all others. A display to be put on according to time-honored tradition by a group of the senior girls. The pièce de résistance of the evening, a pantomime. The music pounded out on the piano would be Star of the East, a song about the signal comet that guided the three wise men. These senior girls had been waiting their whole careers for this. As they prepared for their role, the solemnity of the task infected not only the schoolroom, but blew like smoke out the windows into the very air to be carried far away, beyond recess and even the end of each day, into the surrounding fields and winter woodlands, along the concession roads to everybody's home. Up above the closet where we kept our midday lunches were stored, in dusty boxes of props, gossamer gowns and wands, angel wings and halos made from sadly mangled tinsel. This, my friend Put and I knew, the girls would eventually don to transform themselves from mortal humans into angels, so pure they would represent, in fact, something quite dangerous. Pud's older sister, Soup's sister, a girl we called Stinky because on one occasion she'd had the temerity to wear dime store perfume. The teacher's daughter would become Doris Day and Elizabeth Taylor. Our hopes of witnessing an early version of the transformation were cut short. Get outside, we were ordered on the morning of the dress rehearsal. Reluctantly, we donned coats and mittens to resume our snowball fights, firing away, fueled by frustration and misplaced anxiety. Finally, though, the great night arrived. And after the recitations, skits, songs, and morality plays, it was at last time for the almost sacred event, the senior girls' pantomime. Behind the folds of the curtains at the very foot of the stage, Pud and I sneaked into a secret spot to wait. Breathless. The senior boys in white shirts and dark trousers at the far side of the platform behind the piano comprised the choir, their now changing voices threatening to break out of control at any moment. The spotlight turned on the stage to reveal the girls shimmering in their gossamer gowns, their heads sparkling with the halos of crushed gold tinsel. The room fell silent. A chill ran up every spine. The music began, plunging the girls into their much-rehearsed choreography. Star of the East. Reaching high with their glistening wands and leaning somewhat, they pointed left. O Bethlehem Star. With one hand holding the wand and the other free, our angels became a blur of hands in motion in order to fashion the shape of the star. Leading us on. In a surge of commotion, Mr. Gottfried's planks thundering beneath their feet, all moved rapidly in a counterclockwise rotation a full circle of the stage. From heaven afar. Another reach with the wand. This time toward the far right corner of the schoolhouse ceiling. By now, nervousness and the exertion of the recent gallop had taken a toll. A couple of them snorted like horses. But at the edge of the stage, Pud and I remained mesmerized. Everything was flowing and vapor-like. In the yellow light, particles of suspended dust were like a sea of mist on a meadow, and the girls' wraiths wisping through it. Sorrow and grief. The wands dropped to the floor and heads bowed in downcast remorse. Are lulled by thy light. All heads turned heavenward and arms swung wide and fan-like. Another cavalcade of movement. Stinky went over in her ankle but was able to right herself and continue. Thou hope of each mortal in death's lonely night. O star that leads to God above, beam on, bright star, sweet Bethlehem star. I could hardly catch my breath. My eyes were unable even to blink. The entire room confirmed the solemnity of my own feelings. Only a couple of stray coughs. Had anything so extravagantly beautiful ever before been contrived? It was awesome. For sheer magic, it was hard to believe that between that moment and the end of time, it would be surpassed by anybody, anywhere, ever.
Well, that's Larry Krotz. Larry is happy to have you visit his website, www.larrykrotz.ca. That's K-R-O-T-Z. And I notice it's being copied down in the room. And again, that's larrykrotz.ca, and it's spelled K-R-O-T-Z. A Child's Country Christmas is not available in stores, but is available there. That's Larry's website for $24 shipping included. Larry, that was terrific. And by the way, there's great illustrations for this book. You're the one who felt it and lived it, and so those illustrations had to be just right.
Yeah, the illustrator is a guy named Frankie Ip.
What's his nickname?
Well, interestingly, Frankie lived in Hong Kong until he was 20 years old.
Oh, he missed out.
But he's been able to render rural Western Ontario in his paintings. It's something to look at. Yeah.
Well, it means that he read it and saw it, which is a tribute to the writing. Well, that's a great story, but it brings, of course, we can't avoid this word, nostalgia. There's a problem with your little school is now just a drop-in place, or people come and visit. It's a house now, right? I mean, occupied, used, but it's not a school.
My little school, it's there, but it's a weekend property from somebody from the city. But I used to drive my daughter by there and show her, and now I drive my grandsons by when they're around, and they of course don't believe it. But
you and, by the way, we should all envy you the animals in your life. I'm just thinking. My father went to a school that I went by recently, and there was a bull looking out the window.
Okay.
But you knew some. You got to deal with horses and cows and chickens and pigs. And that's a great experience for a kid.
Yeah.
We're going to agree on that, right?
we're going to agree on that one.
Although maybe it was work. How much was it work, and how much did you enjoy it?
It was a lot of work. You know this line, that the best thing about growing up on a farm is that nothing you do for the rest of your life really feels like work. it was a lot of work, and it was chores, and it was, I remember one of my chores was having to gather the eggs and feed the chickens, but the first task was to have a long stick and drum it on the side of the grain bin so that all the rats would get out before you had to go in and dip out the grain. There is a nostalgia because those kinds of farms are few and far between now. I was in Western Ontario last week. I think I was telling you I'd gone to the church in my hometown to give a reading from the book, and the first person who came up to me was my high school English teacher, who's now.
And did she grade this story?
She took credit for it. At age 93, you're not going to say much in response. But the world there has struggled. One of my friends is an economist, and he's done study after study on rural Ontario, and they've brought in initiative after initiative because, as I mentioned at the outset, both the economy and the culture and the community that we knew those several decades back either don't exist or are under great stress. There was a family on every 100 acres when I was a kid, and now there's a family on every second 100 acres. So that's half as many families with pretty much half as many kids. You know, families that had five kids then now have two kids.
One and a half.
Or one and a half. The farms are all worth more than $1 million, but their agriculture is so kind of cash poor that people have to work off the farm as well as on the farm, and so they have these strategies, you know, for you know,
work in town and keep the farm.
Yeah, and to work in town, you have to create industry in town, and these industries come and go under, you know, various government programs, and or they try to, you know, the latest thing is to have everybody grow a vineyard and have tourists, right? The other thing,
the wine tasters are getting drunk.
That's right. Yeah. The other thing about the rurals is that there would be a viable town about every, you know, about every 10 kilometers or every 15 kilometers. When I was a kid, it had, you know, it had its churches and its schools and its post office and its railway station and its dry goods store and its hardware store and its drug store and its, and
I
its
love
doc-
hardware,
and its doctors. But now, fewer people, better roads, better automobiles. So instead of driving, you know, 10 miles to go to the dry goods store in your local town, you'll drive... you'll drive 100 kilometers to the Walmart in Guelph.
Yeah.
Okay, because
lucky you.
The other thing you're looking, the other thing you're looking for, and this has assaulted the rural communities, is everybody's looking for a bargain.
Mm-hmm.
So
500 miles to a bargain.
That's right. So you'll drive to Kitchener or Guelph and go to the Walmart store, and that's where you'll go for your fun and your restaurant. And all this, and so this is the assault on rural Ontario that that I'm nostalgic for, and I don't have an answer for. But it's a.
And by the way, isn't this across the continent story? In America,
it's across the continent. Yes, absolutely.
But do you see any type of pushback? You alluded to attempts to kind of ameliorate the situation. Are any of them appealing to you? Anybody have any ideas?
Well, they're all kind of appealing in short term ways, as is the whole, you know, holistic and organic farming movement, which is, you know, another.
That is something that seems to be taking hold. That has some traction.
Yeah, that has some traction.
You'd need a real farmer to do this organic
stuff. But you'd need a real farmer to do that.
Yeah, somebody who loves land and maybe his family. Well, our guest has been Larry Krotz, and it's www.larrykrotz.ca, and that's K-R-O-T-Z. The book is A Child's Country Christmas, and it's not available in stores, but is available at the larrykrotz.ca. And it is richly illustrated, and what a great story, and we're very touched, but really glad you came. Larry Krotz, thank you very much, and that's it for the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. See you next week.